name is Frank Chadwick. Welcome to the seminar, which is the best army of World War II. And the description of this seminar deliberately did not say what I supposed to as a teaser. Dana, who set this up, the War College up, finds it interesting that my choice for the best army of World War II to end the suspense is the United States Army. The odds-on favorite for most people is the German Army. I disagree, and we'll talk about a little bit about why, and then we'll do some questions and answers at the end. But it gets me a chance to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is the U.S. Army in World War II. How do you judge what the best army in World War in a war is? And just in terms of organizing this talk, these are the things I guess that I would use as benchmarks or at least thought points: training, tactics, and doctrine. I use those two terms together. Which we'll get into in a little bit. Manpower, leadership, equipment, logistics and sustainment issues, and consistency. And then kind of all of that feeds into the notion of combat effectiveness. And of course, when we say best army, I'm talking about combat effectiveness. Not only as you measure it in terms of ultimately achieving the goals, which is, winning the war, but also kind of a unit-by-unit demonstration of that of the ability to carry out, on the lower level, to carry out missions that achieve objectives, and on the higher level, to identify the objectives that are campaign and war-winning objectives. So, let's talk about some of those things. Training. The principal comparison is going to be the German Army. I'll talk about the German Army as we go as well. I'll kind of touch on some other armies as well. The British Army is maybe the third contender. And I'll talk about the Red Army, but the fourth, as a fourth contender. And I think that the Red Army is in the game, too, by the end of the war. I don't think the British are in the game. No offense to anyone here who's an Anglophile, but I think the British Army, without trying to be incendiary about this, I think the British Army is probably the most overrated army of World War II. And it's clearly the most overrated army of World War I. So let's talk about training. I think that one of the lessons of modern warfare, not just World War II, but modern warfare, is that the most important thing, probably the most important single thing, in unit effectiveness is its training. People talk a lot about experience, but if you have experience getting your ass kicked a lot, that's not necessarily going to make you a combat effective unit. What does is training. And the clearest demonstration of that was actually Gulf War I, where you had an entire United States Army that had, for all practical purposes, never heard a shot fired in anger. That turned in a performance that is probably the most spectacularly competent performance of a field army coming out of the gates in history. And you've probably all heard anecdotes, but some of the stuff from Gulf War I is just staggeringly impressive. I'll give you one real quick one. A U.S. tank battalion in 3rd Armored Division was advancing on the second day of the war. They had received word that there might be some Iraqis in there, but they weren't expecting anything. They had 3 companies online. It was rolling terrain. They came up over a rise, and there was an Iraqi T-72 battalion of the Guard in position, basically an ambush position, waiting for them to come over the rise at about 1,000 yards. The battalion commander keyed his microphone to order the battalion to fire, and before he could say anything, every tank in the battalion fired. And he said it sounded like a volley from in the Revolutionary War when the British would fire, boom! And every round hit. And then, in less than 5 seconds, since there were some double targeting, there were a couple of Iraqi tanks that weren't hit. In less than 5 seconds, the loaders had another Sabre round up. The tanks that hadn't been hit in the first volley were hit in the second. And he said, not only did we not take any hits, the Iraqis did not get a round off. and every tank in that battalion was knocked out and on fire. That's really scary stuff. And that is a function of incredibly good training. These are guys that have never been in combat before, and they just did it right the first time right out of the gate. So, to me, the key thing in establishing the combat effectiveness is training. Both the U.S. and the German Army had kind of an interesting challenge that they shared, and that was that they had to expand their army very, very quickly over the course of a couple of years. The Germans started with about 10 divisions in 34, 35, and it expanded to, geez, how many divisions did they have in Poland? But I mean, by 39 and 40, I mean, it got to be a really big army in the course of about 4 or 5 years. And the U.S. Army expanded from about the same size roughly the same size as the German Army in 39 and 40 in terms of combat divisions in about the same amount of time, in about 5 years. So you have these kind of two examples of armies that had to do this massive expansion, and both these armies have kind of similar growing pains. A shortage of junior leadership and some bumps in training. And when the Germans first go into Poland, and there's kind of this notion that there's, I even heard this term used, the uninterrupted history of German tactical excellence, as if, you know, the German army that learned Stoßtruppen tactics in 1916, 17, and 18 was kind of exactly that same army that fought in Poland and did really well and then went on to France and did really well. And it's not true. The German army in Poland has enormous problems. I mean, it fights just like an army that has just expanded enormously. There's a whole bunch of new units that don't really know what they're doing. The armor does really well. The infantry does really badly. And the Germans spend all of the winter of 39 and 40, the early months of 40, retraining their junior officers and NCOs in the infantry and putting them through really extensive courses because their tactics and leadership at the small unit infantry level in Poland really were bad. They fixed that based on their experience in combat. And then they spend the rest of their training time up until the launch of the offensive in France rehearsing every unit in exactly what they're going to do in the plan. Very much like the U.S. Army in Gulf War I, in place, in theater, rehearsing exactly what they're going to do to execute this attack in Gulf War I. And so when the 1940 attack offensive comes in France, the German army just blows through the French army. I mean, it is the German army's finest hour in World War I, in World War II. Within the last 10 years, a German military historian, a guy in the Bundeswehr, co-authored a book on that campaign called The Myth of the Blitzkrieg. I don't know if any of you have run across it, but it's really a good book. It's basically the equivalent of the modern German official history of the 1940 campaign. And his point is that the achievement of that campaign, the German army, to use a British term, dines out on the 1940 campaign for the rest of its existence. I mean, it makes its reputation in 1940. And from then on, boy, they're the army to beat in Europe. The point he makes, the irony of it is that the reputation the German army has is for flexibility, initiative, ability to improvise, and the success of the 1940 campaign is based upon everybody rigidly rehearsing exactly what they're going to do step by step by step and then executing it. And that's kind of the basis of the success of the 40 campaign, which is completely counterintuitive to what everybody thinks the German army's strengths are. Somebody else is talking about the fact that the Germans had this reputation for being able to assemble units with combat efficiency real quickly from units that had been destroyed and defeated. He said that's because they've got so much experience at being defeated in the East that they get real good at responding to defeat. But that's not necessarily a measure of combat effectiveness in terms of actually winning a war. So the U.S. and Germans face kind of similar issues in terms of training. The Germans improvise a training system that is spotty. They pulled units together from a lot of different places, like Landwehr and border guards and reservists, and from all over the place. The U.S. does to an extent as well in terms of the divisions, but very quickly develops a universal training system that every soldier goes through. It's a really very efficient, and one U.S. historian has called it the division-making machine, that the U.S. gets really good at just making divisions, cranking them out one after another, and they're all exactly the same. If you look at German divisions, they are all over the place. Some of the divisions are pretty good infantry divisions, some of them are static divisions, some of them, the equipment available to them is a hodgepodge. And their training is, they don't really have a universal system for training all these divisions so they all come out the same. Particularly they have big differences between their mobile divisions and their non-mobile divisions. We'll get into that a little bit when we talk about manpower. But anyway, that's the training situation. The U.S. Army ends up with terrifically good training, and I'll give you some examples of that when we get to combat effectiveness. Second thing, tactics and doctrine. Boy, the U.S. ends up with, and there's a couple things I think are important for tactics and doctrine to work. For one thing, you've got to have an army-wide doctrine of some sort. The problem the British have, and this doubles them throughout the war, is that the British, and this is really strange, in the late 20th, early 21st century to say this, but the British in World War II don't believe in doctrine. I mean, we talk about whose doctrine is better, and the British say, we think doctrine is bad. Doctrine squashes the initiative from the brains of junior officers by teaching them school solutions to things when in fact every situation is different, blah, blah, blah. What that really means, with the real problem with the British coming up with across the armed forces doctrine is, every regiment is responsible for training its own men. And so every regiment has its own way of doing stuff. More importantly, you cannot train for combined arms if you're an infantry battalion, because you've got to have armor and artillery and those other guys, and you don't train with them because they're other regiments. The only place in the British Army where you actually get some pretty good combined arms training and it's just bizarre, is in the Guards Armor Division. Because in the Guards Armored Division, every one of the Guards regiments has an armored battalion and an infantry battalion by 44. And so they're from the same regiment and they can actually train together. And it's okay. But everybody else is... the basis of the suspicion of army-wide doctrine is that for most of the people in the army, any piece of army-wide doctrine was written by somebody in a different regiment. And that some fellow from the other regiment tried to tell us how to do things. And so the British have a big problem with doctrine, and where it shows up is in the inability of the British to put together a battalion-sized attack in less than about 48 hours, because there is no doctrine for a battalion-sized attack. So the orders that the British issue for these battalion-sized attacks end up being 30, 40 pages long, because the commander has to specify everything as to exactly how he wants guys to do it. Because if he doesn't, who knows what they're going to do? Whereas the Germans and the Americans both use very, very short mission-oriented orders. And if you read translations of German op orders and U.S. op orders, they look really similar in terms of their length and the sort of things they say, because both of those armies have a basic standard tactical doctrine that they know at every level. Each commander knows what his orders are going to do when he says, go take that hill. He doesn't have to say, take one platoon towards the hill and swing around with another one and keep this one in reserve. That's SOP. And there's this army-wide SOP that frees commanders to do mission and objective-oriented orders that the British don't have. So that's a real problem the British have in tactics and doctrine. The advantage that the Americans have in tactics and doctrine is the simplicity of the basic tactic that the United States Army uses in World War II, which George Marshall pioneers when he's head of the infantry school, And then it becomes, you know, army-wide, particularly under his tutelage when he's chief of the army general staff. And that tactical doctrine is the rule of threes, that your basic maneuver element is broken into three elements. If you're in column, it's lead, second, and third. Excuse me. And the other thing is that the assumption of U.S. tactical doctrine was that the most common battle you're going to fight is a meeting engagement. It's not frontal assaults, it's meeting engagements. And so the doctrine is set up primarily for that, although it's useful for assaults as well. But the doctrine is that your lead element encounters somebody, your lead element engages it with fire. The second element immediately maneuvers, to right or left, depending upon the terrain. That's up to you. And the third element is your reserve element. And if the maneuvering element actually finds an opening and pushes, you put your reserve behind it. If the second element stalls, but your base of fire element is doing better, you put your reserve there and push. But it's all based upon three elements. One is a pinning force, one's a maneuver force, one's a reserve that reinforces success. At every level, that's what a rifle platoon does with its three squads. It's what a rifle company does with its three platoons. It's what a battalion does with its three companies. All the way up to at the core level with divisions, most U.S. corps had a couple infantry divisions and an armor division. See exactly the same thing at the core level. And to an extent, you even see it at the army level with using the British to pin in Normandy and then pivoting with the U.S. First Army. And Patton's Third Army ends up being the exploitation force. I mean, it's a real simple it's great for an army that's expanding rapidly, because as you've got guys going up the chain of leadership, they don't have to learn a whole new doctrine. It's the same thing at every level. So it's simple, it's very flexible, and it emphasizes maneuver. And I think that's really important to remember, that in the armies that are the most successful, in my opinion, throughout in the modern period, are the armies that can maneuver under fire. If you get an army that once you start shooting at it, it just hunkers down and goes forward, it takes big casualties and it doesn't achieve decisive results. The armies that the reaction to fire is to maneuver end up being the ones that really produce battlefield successes. And that's really a hallmark of the U.S. Army. Third thing, manpower. The U.S. Army's got the best manpower of any army in World War II by a couple different measures, the physical health of the manpower. But the big thing is the education. The United States is unique in the late 30s and early 40s in that it has produced the first generation in history anywhere on the planet where that generation went through publicly provided secondary education. In the early part of the Depression is when a lot of secondary schools were built, not just in urban areas but out in rural areas as well. And the people that kind of went through that first generation of secondary education were the ones that were the soldiers that fought World War II. So in the German army, by the end of the war, the German army has commissioned every person, every male in Germany of military age who finished secondary education and who is not unsuitable for leadership. I mean, obviously some people are just completely, can't lead people, or they're criminals or whatever. But it basically, by the end of World War II, if you had a high school, the equivalent of what we would call a high school degree in Germany, you were an officer. And a German rifle company at the end of World War II was authorized two commissioned officers. A company commander and one platoon leader, and the other platoons were commanded by senior NCOs, and German rifle companies in the field averaged one officer actually present with, and some companies were commanded by NCOs. So that's how strapped the Germans were for leadership personnel. A U.S. rifle company was authorized six officers. And almost all of them had them all the time. And there was no shortage of junior officers. And the units were filled up with people who had not only college educations, I mean high school educations, but a lot of guys were college. The United States had this thing called the ASTP, Army Special Training Army Special Training Program, ASTP. And what they did was they didn't, in World War I, the British had a whole bunch of people who volunteered to rifle units and went off to the Western Front and got killed. Their best and brightest went off to war as riflemen and got killed. And so the U.S. said, we're not going to do that. What the U.S. did was everybody who was who scored high enough on aptitude and who had a high school degree, they said, okay, you're in the Army, they put them through basic training, and then they sent them to college. They were going to be the post-war specialists, specialized NCOs and officers during the war, during the Army of Occupation. So all those guys went to college, mostly in engineering and technical branches. So then in about 43, when the huge manpower crunch hit the Army, these guys who would probably have been NCOs and everything, but instead of been kept out of everything, in 43, they just shut ASTP down and said, make those guys riflemen, because we really need riflemen right now. So in 43, there's this huge influx of college students into, and all this time as they're expanding divisions, sometimes they'll pull cadres out and split a division, and then they fill them up with these guys that come out of ASTP. So you've got like the 84th Division is one of the divisions we'll talk about. Ends up with its out of 12,000 guys with about 3,000 or 4,000 ASTP cadets. These are all guys with a couple of years of college. In some cases, a college degree and a year of graduate school, and they go into these things as riflemen. And so by 44, these guys are all become a lot of them are becoming NCOs and specialists. There's an incident in. An attack in the Geilenkirchen salient where a unit gets a rifle company pushes through and gets cut off, and their radio antenna gets shot off, and so they can't communicate back and tell anybody that they're actually on the objective, and they're getting shelled by U.S. artillery who thinks that there's nobody up there, and eventually the company radio operator figures out a way to take an antenna off a handy talkie, which is a little handheld thing. Attach it to this with a piece of signal wire thing on a pole, and work everything up, and they can actually get word back. And it helped that he was a graduate student in electrical engineering, and this is the company radio operator. There's another incident from in the Vosges, a German got captured by an American patrol, and one of the soldiers from the patrol brought the German back for interrogation, and an intelligence lieutenant is interrogating, and who from like the I guess from the battalion headquarters, but he knows the soldier who's brought the German prisoner back, and he's interrogating this German, and the German says, well, yeah, we don't have a chance, we just don't have a chance here. I mean, I'm not even supposed to be a rifleman, I'm a Luftwaffe mechanic, and they just pressed me, and they gave me a rifle, and they put me in the infantry, and I mean, that would have never happened in the U.S. Army, obviously. But then it's like, looks at the guy from the patrol who brought him back and said, what were you doing 6 months ago? I was an Air Force mechanic. but the ability of the U.S. to switch people among occupations, train them up real quick, was a function of the education level. Because if you keep educating people, they develop a habit of learning. So the U.S. did, and there was one of the standing jokes was they take people and if you were a cook, they'd make you a radio operator. If you were a radio operator, they'd make you a mechanic. And it didn't really matter because you could train people very quickly to do whatever job they needed to do because they had this habit of learning. So you have a real problem in some armies that they don't have enough people who can drive trucks because they have to very carefully screen people who know how to drive a motor vehicle. In the U.S., it wasn't a problem. Not just because a lot of people can drive, but because American soldiers are very easy to train in technical issues. So manpower, really, really good manpower in the U.S. Army. And a depth of leadership that was just terrific. I mean, because education is associated with a lot of things in terms of initiative, self-reliance and things like that. So in the Hürtgen Forest, where the U.S. had taken really bad casualties in units. There's some units that there were rifle. There's a, like a rifle platoon that's commanded by a PFC at one point for like a day until they give him some stripes. You know, but he's what's left, and he just steps in and takes over and keeps what's left of the platoon moving forward. They give him some stripes the next day. But there's always guys willing to step in and take over. So that's manpower. Leadership. Pretty good leadership at the highest levels in particular, because George Marshall, the chief of staff, figured what was coming for a long time. And he was ran the infantry school for a while, and he also ran the Commander General Staff College for a while. And he kept a notebook on every officer he met. And so he had this notebook of all these guys who was and was not suitable for division command. So when the Army starts expanding like crazy, Marshall's got his list of division commanders. This guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. And they weren't all perfect, but they were pretty good. But for the most part, they were pretty good picks. You know, the gross incompetency that some armies experienced, the U.S. Army didn't experience. It had some officers that weren't very good, but it was pretty good at identifying them and getting rid of them. And I'll talk about some of that, a couple of those issues a little bit later. But at the highest level, leadership was pretty good. At the NCO level, it was also pretty good. And there's kind of there's this argument that the Germans had better NCOs than the U.S. did, because the Germans had this NCO academy approach where they had specialized NCO schools where they took guys and trained them to be NCOs, and you had to do that before you could be an NCO. And that's about half true. That's about a quarter true. The first way that's a half true is that that's what you had to do to become a regular Army NCO. But the bulk of the German Army were not regular Army. They were reservists. And reserve NCOs were promoted from the ranks just like U.S. NCOs. That is to say, some guy's a pretty good private, okay, we'll make him a Gefreiter, and then see how he does. There's no specialized training. So the specialized training was not a universal German Army thing. It was very narrow to become a regular NCO. And to cut that down a bit, a lot of those, particularly later in the war, a lot of those specialized NCO training units end up not being specialized NCO training units at all. They become combat units because they start mobilizing. They need some really good units, and they end up mobilizing these NCO schools and sending them to the front as combat units. And they're really good little, they're really good infantry combat units, but they end up burning up their NCO training ability that way. And the third problem with this is, even if it does produce some pretty good NCOs, there's not enough officers. So those NCOs don't end up doing NCO things. They end up doing officer jobs. The German company, on average, by the end of the war, is one officer. All those rifle platoons and stuff are commanded by these good NCOs. And like I say, they're either being really okay officers, but they're not doing the NCO part of things, or they're running their platoons like an NCO would without, you know. So it didn't work the way they meant it to, and it doesn't work the way a lot of people say it worked. So I give the edge on leadership. I give an edge on leadership to the U.S. There's some things at the higher level, some problems the Germans have in particular. Their general staff system produces some really good operations guys, because the German general staff always prided itself on operations, and so all the best general staff officers go into operations. The poorest general staff officers get pushed into intelligence and logistics, which is why German Army intelligence and logistics suck in World War II, because those guys aren't really very good at, and nobody thinks much of them in the German Army, and they kind of perform to expectation. But all through the war, the Germans have a problem with getting their logistics organized, and all through the war, everybody's sneaking up on them. You know, the Soviets just play them as suckers over and over and over again after the first year of the campaign. So there are some pretty obvious problems, in the, which you can kind of see where they come from. And that's not a problem that the U.S. has. The U.S. is not as... The operations end of things is more the responsibility of the commanding officer than it is actually the German army. And there was no particular preference or institutional pride based on one or the other of the staff positions. I mean, staff officer, they're all pretty professional in the U.S. Army. And a lot of the guys in the U.S. Army didn't look at themselves as career soldiers anyway, in the staff officer slots. They were people who, in civilian life, had a lot of skills in communication or logistical, you know, logistics or planning, that sort of stuff that brought them into personnel and brought them into the army with them. And so were kind of civilian professionals who became military professionals and had no expectation they were going to be anything more than that for the duration of the war and then go back to civilian life. Okay, so that's leadership. Equipment. Well, the U.S. Army is really well equipped. Everybody kind of, and that, this is kind of a no-brainer. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this. People whine about the Sherman tank, and I think the Sherman tank is one of the best tanks of the war, which always gets, you know, people look at me like lobsters are crawling out of my ears. You know? But in terms of what the tank's supposed to do, the Sherman does it as well or better than any other tank on the battlefield. And people always want to think of tanks in terms of like a gladiatorial contest, you know? As if the measure of a tank is, if you put this tank and this tank together in an arena, who would win? And that's not what happens in the battlefield. And like the clearest example of that I can think of is Clayton Abrams' battalion, which is the 35th Tank Battalion, but it's in the 4th Armored Division. Probably arguably one of the premier tank battalions of the United States Army in World War II. And they're in the 4th Armored Division, so when they arrive in Normandy, they have all 75 millimeter armed Shermans. And the 76s start getting to Europe in August and September. So the combat commander comes to Abrams and says, you know, we're getting all these 76 millimeter armed Shermans. Your guys don't want them. If you take a 76 millimeter armed Sherman, maybe your guys will start wanting them. Now, why does one of the best tank battalions in Europe not want to switch from 75 millimeter armed Shermans to 76 millimeter armed Shermans?
Because they're the way they do the fire maneuver.
Uh-huh.
They're all used to that 75, and they all. They do stuff without even talking to each other.
That's a big part of it. But the reason most people think they would want to switch is the 76 has much better penetration against armor than a 75 does. Okay? Why?
The 75 had better HE rounds, and they were going after the infantry.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. These are tanks that have fought their way all the way across France, and they have learned that the arena of tanks is not part of their life experience, okay? They could get killed by a panther. They could also get killed by being struck by lightning, okay? But that's not the way they lived and died. You know, what killed them was not a panther tank. What killed them was some 17-year-old asshole with a Panzerfaust, okay? That's what they had to face every day. That was the reality of armored warfare. It was not these tank battles we like to talk about. Day in, day out, it was fighting infantry and the combined arms fight. And for that, they thought that the 75 was marginally better. They didn't trust the HE round in the 76. In practice, once they got it, it turned out to be okay. The 76 had an okay HE round for what they needed to do. The real tactical shortage was that they did not have a white phosphorus round for the 76. And they liked using a white phosphorus round as quick smoke whenever they ran into something. When they did actually run into armor, the first thing they do is they put a smoke round on it, and then they maneuver. And so they fixed that by going to a mixed platoon where they had 175 millimeter armed Sherman, kind of as a lead tank, and then seven, and it went with a white phosphorus round in the tube. And so if they ran into anything, boom, they put white phosphorus on it, and then everybody else maneuvers. And so that's kind of, they kind of worked out that. But the important thing is, for 90% of what you need a tank to do, a Sherman would do it. And if you had equipped the United States Army with Panthers, they'd have never gotten to the Rhine. they'd have left them broken down the length of France. The United States Army fought from Normandy to the Rhine, and it's one of the most spectacular and successful advances in modern military history, and they couldn't have done it with anything but the Sherman. And in terms of, you know, trucks, everybody knows the U.S. trucks are great, but there's a kind of an interesting little note to that is there's some accounts of driving forward from Normandy behind the advancing armies. And in the United States sector, the roads coming out of Normandy were lined with 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns because there was, you know, Luftwaffe was just not there. And so they basically ended up parking all these towed 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns by the side of the road and using the trucks for motor transport. Coming out of Normandy behind the British sector, the roads are lined with broken-down trucks. Lined with broken down trucks. The British had a real hard time keeping their truck park moving. And we did not have that problem. And in terms of personal equipment, I mean, yeah, the M1 rifle is the best infantry weapon, infantry personal weapon in World War II by a long shot. The 60-millimeter mortar is a great company mortar. Nobody's got one really very much like it. I mean, the British 2-inch mortar is a little grenade thrower. The Germans kind of throw away their 50-millimeter mortars by 44. And the 60 is a really good mortar. So there's all sorts of stuff that the U.S. has that's really, that in general, best equipment in the world. Logistics and sustainment. I touched on this a little bit already. I mean, the U.S. pays a lot of attention to getting logistics right. And they really do a great job with getting supplies forward and keeping troops supplied, unless there was a deliberate decision to divert supplies to a different area. Then that's the only time we really run into some supply issues. And in Normandy and in France, we do so much better than the planning. We actually outrun nobody figured we were going to... Things go a little slow for the first couple of weeks, but boy, when they break open, they really break. And all of a sudden, we're really outrunning supplies. But we still responded to that pretty well using air transport and everything else and improvising of the Red Ball Express. There were a lot of things we did to keep supplies flowing that worked very well. The U.S. has one thing that the U.S. kind of gets criticized for is our replacement system. And I mean, and to me, this really is crazy. The U.S. has the best and most efficient replacement system in World War II. The problem is not our replacement system. The problem is we don't have enough combat divisions in Europe, and that's a function of shipping and some other things. But since we don't have enough combat divisions in Europe, we can't rotate divisions out of the line and give them a chance to rest often enough. And that's the problem. The problem is not the replacement system. The replacement system does a terrific job of getting replacements up to a unit real quickly. The problem is it gets them there so quickly that if the unit's in combat, some of those guys get killed real quickly. But that's not because of the replacement system. That's because we don't have enough divisions to pull them out of the line to absorb. Some of the common criticisms are that once you go into the system, you don't get back to the same unit. And that's really, for the most part, not true. If you're wounded and out of the unit for a short amount of time, like a few weeks, usually they got you back to the unit that you came from. Particularly the regular army divisions got really good at tracking their own guys in the system and getting them back. The 4th Infantry Division, which is a regular army unit, is fighting in the Hürtgen Forest. And some of their rifle companies are taking 30 and 40% casualties in a day. And the next morning, they're back up to strength and attacking again. How do you absorb those guys and be combat cohesive? Well, some of the NCOs that they're getting that night were guys that were wounded in Normandy from their division, from that company. You know, and not, okay, they come back, they still know that, you know, some of the commanders, those that are still alive, they know some of the guys, and they're able to reintegrate their returning wounded along with replacements and keep going. By contrast, here's how the German, I don't even want to call it a system, Here's how the German army replacement system works. At the end of the month, you fill out a report that tells how many of your people were lost that month. And if they're still in hospital, they're still part of your unit. You'll get a replacement for them. The only people you get replacement for are people who were killed or permanently lost through capture. Or they're at some point the hospital is going to certify them as not coming back. And then at the end of the next month, you get those replacements. So basically, a guy that gets killed in the first week, of a month, you'll get a replacement for him in about 7 weeks. Okay? So in the Hürtgen Forest, when you have U.S. units that are taking 20-30% casualties in a day, and the next morning they're back up to 80% strength and attacking, the unit across from them are just melting away. The German division units are just melting away. And you end up with units that go in as a regiment. In a week, they're turned into a consolidated battalion. And another unit comes to the line, and that unit absorbs that as one of their battalions. And in another week, that unit has become a consolidated battalion. And what was a battalion here was originally a regiment, is now a company in that thing. These things are just disappearing. And the experienced cadres are disappearing and are being absorbed. And this myth that the Germans pull a unit out to rebuild it, all they're pulling out is the headquarters and service units and some of the artillery. The infantry basically stays in the line and is absorbed by whoever comes in behind them. So if you're an infantryman in the German army in 44 in heavy fighting, you're in the line until you're dead. it's that simple. And the units just keep disappearing and disappearing and disappearing. One of the reasons German morale in the infantry even starts cracking in 44 is because they're lousy replacement system. Because there's just the cohesion of the units is being destroyed because they can't sustain units. They have no ability to sustain units in combat. So that's sustainment. Consistency. The U.S. Army is a pretty cohesive army. I mean, you've basically got infantry and armored divisions, and they're all drawn from the same manpower pool. You have a few specialized units like airborne that are volunteer units, rangers that are volunteer units, but the bulk of the army are units with a common tactical basis and a common capability. The German army is a very heterogeneous army. They're mobile units, the panzer divisions and panzer grenadier divisions, are very capable units because they're getting the pick of leadership. Some of it's self-selecting, but the most aggressive leaders end up in the mobile divisions, partially because that's where they want to go for the action, partially because they're making an effort to get the most aggressive leaders and competent leaders in those mobile divisions. They're getting the pick of the manpower that goes to the mobile divisions. And that leaves the bulk of the German army, particularly later in the war, with the leavings. And it's really clear in terms of performance that that's what's going on. So the German army becomes really two different armies. There's the good German army that everyone likes to talk about and compare, U.S. military capability to panzer divisions, which is the best thing the Germans can put in the field. Nobody wants to talk that much about the vast bulk of the German army, which is the infantry divisions. And sometimes you get passing people saying, well, yeah, they're pretty good too. Let me talk now about some particulars in combat effectiveness. 84th Division, the rail splitters. There were three types of U.S. infantry divisions. There were regular divisions, National Guard divisions, and Army of the United States of America, which is AUSA. AOUSA. Regular divisions were the pre-war regular divisions. National Guard divisions were state-raised National Guard divisions that came into federal service. And AOUSA divisions were divisions formed from scratch during the war. That's what Army of the United States of America divisions were. The 84th Division had been a National Guard division in World War I, but then it was disbanded. And so they used the number for a division of an Army of the United States of America division formed from scratch. They were cadreed a couple of times. They get over to France in late October of 1944, when the advance across France has already run up against the West Wall. And they are sent in the northern end of the U.S. line. They become the northernmost division in early November, late October, early November of the United States Army. They are so far north that the division to the north of them is the 44th Wessex Division. And as they get there, they're short of corps headquarters, so they put them under 30 corps command momentarily. So when they go into combat for the first time, they're under British command on the northern end of the front, and they are going against a chunk, and they're baptism of fire. You know, these divisions get easy introductions. Here's your first job. We're going to send you against the Geilenkirchen salient, which is the most heavily fortified stretch of the Siegfried line. That's what you get to do out of the gate, your baptism of fire, a deliberate assault against this double belt of concrete fortifications and minefields and barbed wire, and you get to do it in the worst autumn weather on record. Normally it rains in November, normally it rains in that part of Germany, 12, 15 days of during the month. And it rained like 25 days out of that month. I mean, it just rained constantly. The roads turned into quagmires. They couldn't get, the tanks could move forward on the roads. The tanks could get off the roads. Wheeled vehicles couldn't even get forward on the roads after a while. Some of the units, I've seen pictures of this and also read accounts. The ground was so saturated with water that the foxholes filled up with water. So you see you'll look across the field and there's these circular spots, like mirrors on them, and those are the foxholes. There are guys who, when they were under bombardment, had to hold their breath and go under water to stay in cover, and then kind of come up and take a breath because their foxholes were lit full of water right up at the top. It was just unbelievably bad. Initially they were up against the 184th Volksgrenadier Division, which lasted about a day against the 84th Division. And at the end of the day, they moved the 15th Panzer Grenadier in and absorbed what was left of the 184th Volksgrenadier Division. The 84th kind of burned through those guys. By the end of the fight, the Germans had thrown in the 9th Panzer Division and the 10th SS Panzer Division, and still couldn't. There was a pause of 4 or 5 days in the middle of this. But by the end of it, the 84th Division had just pushed through all these guys, and was ready to do the assault crossing on the Roar River when the Ardennes offensive started, and so they were pulled out and sent down to the Ardennes. And this is a green division, and they just, in the worst imaginable conditions, and they just ate through these guys. They just chewed up about 4 German divisions. Further south in the Vosges Mountains, the Germans had prepared part of the High Vosges, the real mountainous terrain, they brought in organization Tote, and dug these concrete emplacements and everything, and really difficult terrain, and they really spent a lot of time fortifying it, and they put a fresh Volksgrenadier Division at full strength in there holding this. And the weather was lousy, so there was no air support. And that was the thing, the 84th Division had no air support because of the weather was lousy. But in the Vosges, mountainous terrain, no weather support because of terrible weather, very limited artillery support because it was in mountainous country and it was lousy weather, so it was really having a hard time getting ammunition up. And a full strength, which was not that great, but I mean, it's a full strength Volksgrenadier Division in hard entrenchments. And the U.S. 100th Division, the Century Division, fights its way up the Vosges and then just goes right through these guys. And von Mellenthin, the German Panzer General, it was actually the chief of staff of the army defending this part. In his memoirs, he says, you couldn't expect our Volksgrenadiers to stand up against elite American assault divisions, like the Century Division. This was the 100th Division's baptism of fire. Okay? They were not an elite assault division. They were a product of the United States training system that cranked out division after division after division that just came out of the blocks fighting like pros. There were a couple of exceptions. But the exceptions are kind of illuminating as well. In Normandy, the 99th Division did not do particularly well at first. It had a lot of problems. And so what they did was, they kind of looked at one of its failed actions, and at the end of it, they relieved the division commander, I think two of the three regimental commanders, and a few other guys. And after that, 99th Division turned around. And the 99th Division was a great division from then on. Which means it wasn't a different sort of division than anything else. It just had four or five senior leaders that didn't quite have it down. You didn't quite know what they were doing. And that was kind of the interesting thing, is when you had a problem with the division, you replace four or five guys at the top, and the division turns around. So it's basically, all these divisions have the capability to be these really good divisions if you've got the right guys leading them. Kind of the same thing is true of the 106th Division that loses so much. He loses two-thirds of the division in Normandy, in the Ardennes. They just never had a chance to replace those guys. The division gets cut off. Two of its regiments end up surrendering. What's our time?
11:25.
Okay, good. So we still got time to. This is supposed to go until. I'm just about done with my prepare stuff, then we'll do Q&A. But the 106th, looking back at what the guys who are the enlisted personnel and the junior leaders in the 106th, and the two regiments that surrendered, what becomes clear is that the guys in the rifle regiments didn't think they were beat, didn't want to give up, and wanted to fight their way out. And it was kind of a failure of morale of a couple regimental commanders that really led to this giant mass surrender of U.S. troops. It was not a problem with the troops. It really was a problem. A problem with a couple of bad leaders. And that's the sort of thing that's pretty easy to fix. And we can talk about Kasserine if you want to. But I think Kasserine really... You want to talk? Want me to talk a little bit about Kasserine, then we'll do Q&A?
Sure.
Okay. Kasserine's an interesting battle, and it's referred to over and over and over again as some sort of proof that our U.S. Army is not very good at the start of the war when it's in Tunisia. I don't think it proves that at all. If you look at what happens at Kasserine, in the whole campaign in Kasserine, the whole Kasserine campaign, initially the German attack catches one understrength regimental combat team and one combat command completely by surprise, and the surprise is mostly a function of a British Army commander, Anderson, not listening to Eisenhower, who keeps telling him, you need to concentrate the 1st Armored Division. You need to get the 1st Armored Division right, but, well, as soon as I can, I will. No, you need to concentrate these guys because they're spread out all over the place. Anderson, the British commander, ignored that, and 1st Army, British 1st Army, did not pick up on the fact that there was a German attack coming. They were the ones responsible for alerting the corps commanders as to the situation. So U.S. 2nd Corps, the Ford elements get caught. And that one regimental combat command, which has got a reinforced infantry battalion, and one armored combat command get beat up pretty bad. Even then, one of the infantry battalions holds out for 2 days and then tries to fight its way out and almost makes its way out. But it gets caught out in the open by armor when the sun comes up. But nobody in that action really does anything but fight really, really hard under impossible circumstances. The next major action is a U.S. tank battalion is thrown in by 1st Army, basically saying, go in there, you've got some people that are that are out of touch, and there's some command problems there. One tank battalion unsupported goes in against basically two panzer divisions, and it loses all its tanks. But, surprise! But in the process, that battalion makes its transition from an attack to understanding that it's up against more than it can handle to doing a retrograde action to cover the withdrawal of all the soft parts of a combat command behind it, and loses all its tanks in the process, but the whole rest of the command gets out. And it does it in a really pretty professional way. I mean, the way that battalion fights is pretty impressive. The bulk of 1st Armored Division, when it gets assembled at Spitla, a day later, 2 days later, gets hit by the Germans. It's a tough fight. It ends up getting beat, and it falls back. And in the course of falling back, it gets hit by German airstrikes. Now, everybody talks about this as being an example of, you know, green American troops panicking or anything else. No, it was a pretty orderly withdrawal. The hardest thing to do under fire is to withdraw under fire. Not only are they withdrawing under fire, but they start being hit by air power. And a day later, that force is assembled on a defensive position and ready to go. And they hold that defensive position against the Germans for the rest of the fight. The approaches to Basin. The big fiasco in Castering Pass itself is an engineer regiment that's not really ready for combat. A few odds and ends attached to it, and five different commanders, three of them British, two of them American, trying to tell these guys what to do. I mean, that's a fiasco, but it's not really representative of what's going on in the United States Army overall in Tunisia. And then the last act of the Kasserine campaign is when the Germans almost break through the British force at Thala, and they are stopped by the timely arrival of the divisional artillery of the U.S. 35th Division, which basically unlimbers and over open sight starts blowing up tanks with their 105 howitzers. So, I mean, it's hard to me to look at the overall Castering campaign and say, this shows the Americans don't know what they're doing, because it shows a lot of American units that fight really well under kind of challenged leadership. And I see that as partly the responsibility of the commander of 2nd Corps, Fraden Hall, who's a really good trainer but not a great combat leader, and a lot of the responsibility goes on the shoulders of General Anderson, commander of British 1st Army, who, you know, and Eisenhower had a policy in Tunisia that no Americans were allowed to speak ill of the British, and his other policy was, what the British say is up to the British, I'm not going to interfere there, in the interest of Allied cooperation. And so out of the Tunisia comes a lot of British guys bad-mouthing the Americans, and no Americans allowed to defend themselves. And that's kind of gotten stuck in our reading of the battle. I think fairly or unfairly, it's not a question of fairness, it's a question of accuracy. I mean, I don't think it's an accurate reading of what happens at that battle. And what's probably more important in the long run is that, in the course of this, by the way, everybody forgets that we actually won that campaign, the Kasserine part of the campaign, because the Germans were trying to do some very specific objectives. We stopped them short of all those objectives and then pushed them back. But more importantly, it was really the last time the U.S. suffered a major reverse at the hands of the Germans. I mean, from then on, every time we fight the Germans, we beat them. And so, to me, there's not. That's my feeling about why I think the U.S. is the most effective army in World War II, the best army in World War II. So, Q&A. Yes.
Yeah, you talked about the education system, mm-hmm. Being able to train people real quickly. Do you think there's anything about, you know, in the education system, most guys were playing sports, baseball, football, which there's a lot of teamwork involved, initiative, it can get violent. Do you think there's any, did that help give us an edge over a lot of the Europeans?
In some ways, yes. Certainly one of the things that they looked for in junior officers were guys that were in team sports. They were used to working together in teams, but they were also, a lot of them used to, you start developing some leadership skills in team sports as well. The other thing is, it's important not to forget the importance of physical conditioning for a soldier. One of their kind of elite units were mountain divisions. And why were mountain divisions elite? Because their guys were really in good physical condition from climbing up and down things. Within German units, elite assault troops were engineers. Why were engineers elite assault troops? Because engineers are really strong from lifting boards and, you know, girders and stuff. They do physical work a lot. the European armies were not blessed with really strong physical guys throughout their force structure. So where they had guys that were really good, it was really important, because in sustaining infantry combat, you've got to carry ammunition with you, you've got to be physically active, and you've got to keep that up for a long period of time, and remain mentally alert. And if you're not physically strong with a lot of endurance, you become mentally dull, and the units, it's hard to sustain the unit. And it's one of the reasons that the Germans in World War I gave extra rations to the Stoßtruppen, and they were selected for being young and physically fit, so they could keep moving forward, carrying all their ammunition with them and everything else, and keep an attack going in World War I. And you kind of have that within the German force structure with engineered units and mountain units and stuff like that. The U.S. Army doesn't have any specialized stuff like that, because it was a pretty healthy manpower pool to begin with, and very well fed and, you know, and very strong. But the physical conditioning and sports were an important part of that. Yeah?
I was thinking equipment.
What's that?
Equipment. T-O-N-E.
Yeah.
The United States had, they found something that worked, efficient, mm-hmm. and they made millions of them. That was all they had. Whereas the Germans, I mean, how many different German tanks are there?
Lots. Lots and lots of different variants of them. Of course, we have lots of variants of the Sherman. We keep improving it. The Germans did tend to have a lot of, not just different tanks, but different assault guns and artillery and special and self-propelled guns of this sort and that sort. And they're all, and it was kind of easy to... it was like entrepreneurialism run wild. You know, everybody who had an idea, a wacky idea for a weapon, could kind of pitch it to someone. Go ahead and try that. And U.S. industrial production of weapons was much more rationalized. In World War I, there were problems with us getting equipment to the soldiers. We ended up using French guns because U.S. guns never quite got there. We ended up using a lot of Allied equipment. Now, partially that was a rationalized. We said if we send you the raw materials and we'll take the guns, that works easier than us building guns. But also it was a problem with getting equipment to the troops, because the ordnance department kept tinkering with it, and they never quite got it ready for the troops because they were always making it better. So in World War II, we had a hard and fast rule that ordnance would not change stuff once it was issued unless Forces Command asked them to. And for the most part, that worked very well. There were a couple hiccups. One of them was the 76mm arm Sherman. Ordnance was ready to produce a 76mm arm Sherman late 43, I think, or early 44. And Forces Command said, nope, don't need it. 75 is fine. Until we got into Normandy. In Normandy, finally, we're really facing Panthers for the first time. They were there in Italy, but Italy was not really much. It wasn't as much of a tank heavy fight. But in Normandy, you get a lot of armor on both sides, and all of a sudden, Forces Command saying, "Geez, we need some of those 76 armed Shermans like right now." And Ordnance got them real quickly. They put them in production and got them there. Started getting them there in about 6 weeks, I think. Because they were ready to go. But, I mean, that was kind of a hiccup. We could have had the 76mm arm Sherman much earlier. We probably could have had a 90mm arm tank. We could have had the Pershing much earlier. But we didn't think we needed a heavy tank. But there were some hiccups, but for the most part, you're right. It worked. It was a system that worked very well.
Yeah. In regards to new equipment, one of the things we had to take into consideration was shipping it overseas. The Germans didn't.
That's absolutely true.
What was the deal with the Sherman? For each, that they could ship four Shermans in the place of one Pershing?
Something like that, yeah. The Pershing was a real luxury. It was not a necessity. It was a luxury. And the only reason we shipped them at all was just we wanted some experience with them in combat. There's a great little World War II museum up in Wolfsboro, New Hampshire. At least you live in New Hampshire. I was just driving around up there and found it, And at the front of this building, it's got a whole bunch of bricks in front, and there's an M3 Stuart poised there as if it's smashed under the front of the building. And it's a great, it's got some nice stuff, but it's got a nice vehicle park of about 12, 14 vehicles, including a Pershing. And I would go up there periodically and go through it. One time I went up there and they had the vehicle area cleared out and it was all set up for a banquet. They were having a fundraising banquet. So I was talking to the curator and I said, that's too bad the vehicle's there. He said, yeah, he says, too bad you weren't here earlier because we actually, all the vehicles won. We fired them up and drove them, opened the big doors and drove them out to the storage shed. And he says, and when we started the Pershing, everybody started cheering because it's just incredibly loud, these big roaring engines. And I said, it's too bad I missed that. And then he just said in passing, yeah, that's the last Pershing that actually fought at Remagen Bridge.
Whoa.
That's one of the three Pershings, and the only one surviving that fought at, and there were only like, 12 Pershings, I think, in the ETO. And there was a platoon of three of them at Remagen Bridge, and one of them burned out for an engine fire or something, and one of them fell into the river or got scrapped or something. And the third one is at the museum in Willsboro, New Hampshire, and still running. Really cool. So, yeah, that was a...
Frank, you talked about, you mentioned briefly the British and the Russian armies. What are one or two things that the Brits and the Russians did that exceeded the U.S. capabilities? And looking back at it, is there anything that the U.S. could have or should have learned a little earlier from what those armies excelled at?
I'm not sure there's anything the British do that exceeds us, but the one of the things they do that's nearly as good is their artillery. Their artillery doctrine. Well, I didn't talk about artillery doctrine. The U.S. has the best artillery doctrine in World War II, to the point that it is today the artillery doctrine of the world. Prior to World War II and up into World War II, the basic unit of fire was the battery in every army. And the United States Army in the interwar years develops the Fire Direction Center, the FDC concept, where the battalion controls all the fire of all of its tubes instead of each battery firing independently. And that doctrine, that's why every artillery unit in the world today has fire direction centers at the battalion level, because it really, really worked great. And the British come close to approximating it by the end of the war. They don't really, they're still not quite up with this, but other than the U.S., the British, I think, have the best artillery doctrine of the war. And the Germans are really, we learned one thing from the Germans before the war, and that is the Germans kind of pioneered this forward observation officer. We've got an officer with a radio or a field telephone with the unit that's being supported. So the battery pushes its FOs not just out there to find a good position, but with the unit commander that's supported, so that a rifle company or a battalion commander will have the artillery officer right there with the communication equipment. And he says, I need fire here, and the guy calls back to the battery, and boom, the fire gets there. So we borrowed that from them, and the British kind of develop it independently. That's very effective, but the problem with the German system is that's as far as it went, which means if you need artillery fire right now, you're going to get that battery right away. And that's it. And half an hour from now, you still got a battery. And it's very, very difficult for the Germans to get massed fire in a mobile situation where it's not static. Where it's static, they can do pre-planned fires and stuff like that. But if you're in a mobile situation, basically you've got a battery. And the U.S., in mobile situations, you can get a division's worth of artillery if you ask real nice, and everything, and the stars come together. But you can certainly get a battalion, on target. So they're close. Let me finish. What did the Soviets do that's better than us? The Soviets are better than us at the operational level. Nobody is as good as the Red Army by the end of World War II at operational level maneuver. They are just really masters of it, and we don't get it. We really don't get it until about the 1980s. We really don't. You read guys writing about this. This operational stuff, well, that's just like the layer between tactics and strategy. No, it's a completely different type of warfare and a completely different way of looking at warfare. And it's not really until a guy by the name of David Glantz becomes the first head of the Soviet Army Study Office, SASO, and he starts translating all the Soviet doctrinal writing into English at Leavenworth and circulating it, that it's that kind of becomes the theoretical basis for this kind of birth of this new thinking of operational art in the U.S. Operational art is something that 10 years before Gulf War I, nobody in the U.S. Army knows how to say those words. And by Gulf War I, there's just been this revolution in military thinking in the U.S. Army, and it all comes out of the Soviet approach to operational art that I think David Glantz is probably the most important in bringing that to the attention of the U.S. Army. So that's what the Red Army does better than us. So, yeah?
So I want to go to some of the other armies.
Okay.
Okay. I want to switch it. How about Pacific? And hearing your criteria, I sort of know where the Japanese are going to fall, but I'd still like to hear your opinion. And then the ones that always have intrigued me, I don't have a lot of respect for the British Army either, but I have much more for the Canadians and the Australians. Uh-huh. So how do they work in?
Okay. Well, first I'll tell you an anecdote. A friend of mine got involved in an online dispute with a British fellow who was saying that the American Army wasn't any big deal in World War II because all you did was just had a lot of firepower. That's all you just, your solution, I think, was firepower. You were addicted to firepower. And he said, and his answer was, well, we had to be. We didn't have any Canadians. I think the Canadian Army was a very good army in World War II. A small and it had the advantage of, I mean, it was a small army. It was also a effectively a volunteer force, and that has advantages and disadvantages. But the Canadian Army, I thought, was, I don't think much of Carrar, the commander of 1st Canadian Army. Is it Carrar? No. Yeah, Carrar was a British general. I'm trying to think of who the commander of 1st. Anyway, I think he was kind of a plotter, but I think the Canadian troops were excellent. And they all fought with British doctrine. They fought all with all the limitations of that. But the Canadians were less crippled by the regimental system. That kind of had ossified the British. I mean, what the British Army suffers from is the fact that the strategic outlook of the British Empire was essentially colonial, even in World War II. And that is to say, they were interested in maintaining their position as a global power, and that mostly meant navy, air power, and defending colonial distant possessions. And way down on the priority is putting together an effective army to fight mass warfare on the plains of Europe. Very distant priority. And that percolates through the whole mentality of the British Army. There's a fellow by the name of John Masters, who I think is a great writer. I mean, I really like, he's passed away now, but he was a British Gurkha officer, an officer of Gurkhas before World War II, and then fought in the British Indian Army during World War II, and ended up at the very end of World War II, he was in temporary command of a Chindit brigade in Burma, and in the last gasp Japanese offensive in Burma, like late 44, early 45, his Chindit brigade was surrounded. It was being attacked from all sides by the Japanese, and he had kind of this desperate last stand. They're not a last stand, but they're a pretty desperate situation. And he's having this Ogub, but he didn't report this. This was reported by a junior officer who was at the Ogub. Masters never wrote about this. So it was really weird having read all this stuff about Masters, then seeing him in someone else's reminiscence from a different angle. And the guy said that when they finish, Masters finishes the Ogub, and then he says to the officer, he says, "All right, now let's get this business with the Japanese wrapped up so we can all get back to some real soldiering." That's the British Army. This stuff with World War II is a distraction from real soldiering. And that to me tells you volumes about the British Army. And that's an officer I really admire a lot. So really, the Japanese. My quick take on the Japanese. No army in World War II has infantry so willing to give themselves for their country and nobody has officers who squander that more irresponsibly than the Japanese. The Japanese make a decision in about 1938 that if they're going to be involved in a war with a European, as a result of the clashes with the Soviet Union along the frontier, both at Khalkhin Gol and at Lake Khasan, they realize they're going to be involved in any sort of fights with Western powers. They cannot match the technical ability of Western conventional ground forces, armor, artillery. Everybody thinks about armor, but it's also artillery. The Japanese just can't. At Khalkhin Gol, the Japanese throw in the high command reserve artillery unit that is their high technology, high power command reserve artillery. This is their battle winner, and it's a regiment that consists of two batteries of 155 millimeter howitzers and two batteries of 105s, four batteries of artillery, mechanically towed and modern guns, and that's it. I mean, that's like their that's the. And some of them are good. We got about 500 guns. I mean, the Japanese realize, but we are just so out of our league here. So they make the conscious decision that the only way they can match the West is in ground forces is with superior is with some sort of superior moral approach. And so that's when they really start emphasizing, you know, duty is heavy, death is light, is, you know, a butterfly, whatever the hell, you know, and on a certain level they know it's bullshit, but they decide very cynically that it's the only card they have to play, and they're willing to, before the war even really begins, make the decision that they're just going to expend their soldiers' lives as an alternative to. Developing better equipment, because the industrial ability they have needs to go into the navies and air forces, where you absolutely have to have the best. So that's the deal. That's the story in the Japanese. The other questions were.
Well, I was going to add to that.
All right.
David Glantz's he did an article on Manchuria, mm-hmm. and you look at the TONE of the Russian or the Soviets, and you look at the TOE of the Japanese. It's like.
It's not a contest.
Was it the speed bump?
Yeah, it was really a speed bump, yeah.
Oh, I had
it. There were some other armies you were asking about?
Actually, you covered them all.
Oh, okay.
But I had a follow-up question on your David Glantz, the whole operation theory of the Soviets. How much of that is influenced by the geography of the Soviets? Because they're coming out of a vast plain. And we are fighting in a vast plain of sand right now. Mm-hmm. But it's still, how much of that is what is... contributing to the success of that level.
I don't think that's it. In my opinion, that's not what's it. The guy that writes most persuasively on operational art of the pre-war guys is a fellow by the name of Svechin, who is a really interesting guy in a lot of ways. But he ends up purged before Tukhachevsky because he disagrees with Tukhachevsky about some things. And I think his view of modern war is much more perceptive than Tukhachevsky's was. But Svechin, but all of it comes out of this realization that in World War I, the modern industrial state is able to put so many troops in the field that there is no longer armies maneuvering to a battlefield, and then a battle decides... Instead, it's become continuous fronts, that the armies are continuously engaged along their entire front. There's no longer things like Borodino, or where you'll come and you'll have a battle where an army commander can kind of see that, and that's grand tactics, where an army commander can kind of encompass in his mind this battlefield and maneuver units on it. That's grand tactics. What he said was that's no longer the way our war works. The operational art is the recognition that there are, since you have continuous fronts and continuous engagement, you have to think in terms of strategic objectives. And their definition of an operation becomes the sum total of all the tactical actions which contribute to the achievement of a single objective of strategic significance. That's an operation in the sense of the operational art. And that's a completely different way of thinking of things. And it takes us a while to get there. I mean, and I think some of us instinctively, so, like Patton and some other mobile workers instinctively thought that way, but without ever articulating it. And so, the big breakthrough was when we started articulating it in the 80s and training people to think that way and plan that way. And if you look at Gulf War I, it's a textbook Soviet front offensive. I mean, it's just textbook. Here's the holding force. Here's the maneuver force. Here's the operational maneuver group going deep. The OMG, this classic Soviet stuff. And even to the point where the commander of the armored cavalry regiment in 7th Corps, when they were getting ready to go, he wrote to Tradoc and said, "Send me everything you've got on core advanced covering force, operations and stuff." And Tradoc wrote him back and said, "What do you want that stuff for? Nobody does that but the Russians." Well, flash for your balance, exactly what we're going to be doing in Iraq, in Kuwait. So, yes.
Just to round it off, what do you think of the French and the Italians?
Okay, yeah, good question. The French are not as bad an army as they have a reputation. Neither one of them are as bad an army as they kind of have a reputation for. The French are crippled by their command structure. Their units execute pretty well. Most of their units. There's some soft spots in the army because of the reserve system where you have some units that are really, really bad. And if you put a bunch of those guys in, you end up with a soft spot in the front, and that causes a disaster to Sedan. But there's a fight at Stone where the Grossdeutschland regiment gets involved and fights over the course of a couple of days with some French regular units. And there's an officer in that fight, a German officer who fought like at Kursk and at Stalin, in the Stalingrad campaign and everything else, and he says the hardest fight of the war was Stone. That was the toughest fight. Those are the toughest guys that he fought in the whole war. So the French army at the unit level is pretty good, but their command level is terrible. And part of it, I think, is because their heart. Politically and socially, the high command of the French army's heart just isn't in it. They don't really want to be fighting the Germans because the Germans don't like Jews, just like the established order in the French army doesn't like Jews. They're still smarting the Dreyfus affair. So, as far as they're concerned, yeah, come in and kill them. There's some real loyalty enthusiasm issues, I think, in the high command, and that really shows up in how they respond to this. And their communication system's terrible. But at the unit level, they're not bad. They have an archaic artillery doctrine, but so does everybody else at the war, except for the British and the Germans to an extent. But at unit level, they're pretty competent. And their mortar instruments are very good. Their armored divisions are badly organized, but well led for the most part. So it's an army that has a real bad day and never gets a second day, never gets a second bite at the apple. The Italian army, oh God, I really like the Italians. And they're really maligned. The real problem, the Italians early on have a problem with manpower and leadership. And they kind of, and everybody kind of knows that, the Italians have, we talked about education. Something like 50% of the incoming Italian recruits from southern Italy in World War II did not know right from left. So the first thing you have to tell them before you can teach them to drill is right and left. And you compare that to the education level of the U.S. Army. But it's an enormous problem with education, an enormous problem with lack of people who have technical skills to do things like mechanic, radio, all these technical branch stuff. And a social difference in the country that comes from the North being more prosperous and better educated. So the North tends to provide all the technical branch people, all the officers, and then the South provides the infantry enlisted men. And that's one of the reasons there's a big gulf between officers and enlisted men initially, because it's a regional thing and a social thing as well. You know, as Yankee officers and hillbilly enlisted men. It's kind of the Italian equivalent of how they look at it. And there's just this big gulf. And that's a big problem early on. By 42 in North Africa, that problem's mostly solved. You have a whole new branch. The officers who don't want to command are gone. And the senior officers, you've got are pretty good. The junior officers are very good. The soldiers really know what they're doing. The problem that catches up with them in 42 is they have no, their military industry is so poor that there's no follow-on generation of weaponry coming. So in 42, everybody else in the desert is getting this new generation of weaponry. The British are replacing 2-pounders with 6-pounders. They're replacing cruiser tanks with American 75-millimeter armed tanks. The Germans are getting 50-millimeter anti-tank guns. They're getting a new generation. There's no new generation of stuff for the Italians. You know, they've still got the same stuff they started the war with, and they fight this whole war with it. So they're technically fall way behind the curve at that point. And the only way they can even keep their guys in North Africa supplied with a fair quantity of equipment is by stripping it out of divisions that are still in metropolitan Italy. So by the time the North African campaign is over, there's the main army in Italy is a shell, because all the stuff like radios, motor transport, anti-tank guns, and modern artillery has all been stripped out of those divisions and sent to North Africa as replacements. And so there's just nothing left to fight with. But within that, there are some units that are very good. The Alpini are very good. The Bersaglieri are very good. And there's a small number of units called Guastatori, assault engineers, who are crazy. I mean, they're really, really, really very good. And there's a tendency to form within Italian units special assault groups called Arditi. You know, we're volunteer assault units, and we're kind of the self-selected assault troops within units that are pretty good. So, and the Italian divisions in North Africa, after the initial British offensive, the Italian divisions that had fought alongside Rommel, some of them fight really, really well, and better than the Germans give them credit for, because the Germans don't look very well on any of their allies. I mean, the Germans are, in World War II, you know, go figure, they're just a bunch of kind of arrogant pricks, you know, who are contemptuous of their enemies and contemptuous of their allies, or contemptuous of everybody who's not a German. So I think the Germans give the Italians a raw deal in terms of their performance.
Yeah, you mentioned about how the...
How are we doing on time, by the way?
We're
at time, but go ahead. Yeah.
You mentioned how the Germans were adversely affected by the best officers going into operations. The way the Marines get around that today is when they graduate from OCS, they have 300. And they break them down into groups of 100 to select what their MOSs are. So if you graduate number 100 and you want to be a platoon leader, you're probably going to end up in communications or intel. But if you're number 201, you can pick whatever you want.
That's interesting.
So this way we make sure that you know, the best guys aren't all concentrated in one area, and they get good guys into logistics and communications and intelligence.
Yeah. And of course, the Marines have, and I'll finish it with this, but the Marines have a unique unique sense of esprit de corps and self-identification. You know, everybody is a rifleman, you know, because, yeah, maybe you're a communications guy, but what are you first? You're a rifleman. And there's a great story from Gulf War I about that. Marine Lieutenant Colonel commanding a FA-18 Hornet squadron. And nobody knew what the first day of airstrikes were going to be like, but, I mean, obviously they were spectacularly successful. Everything we want, you know, everything we figured out about how to crack a fixed air defense system worked like a charm. And so all these airstrikes, all these air packets went in, and everybody came back, you know, having dropped their ordnance on target, and hardly any casualties, and we came back, and somebody interviewed this guy, and he was obviously, you know, just really high as a kite, you know, he had adrenaline when it just happened. And they said, you know, would you identify yourself and what you do? And he said, Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so, Marine rifleman, currently driving an FA-8. Yeah, I mean, Marine Lieutenant Colonel Squadron Commander, FA-18. What does he identify? Several Marine Rifleman, currently driving an FA-18. Thanks very much for coming, guys.